am Plante on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Jan Wong was born and raised in Montreal. In 1972, at the height of the Cultural Revolution in China, she was one of only two Westerners permitted to enroll at Beijing University. A fellow student, Ian, approaches Wong and asks for help in getting to the United States. Wong, then a Maoist, immediately reports Ian to the school's authorities. She confessed this in her previously best-selling 1996 book, Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. And though she returned to China in 1999 to research and write a second book, as well as make a documentary, Jan Wong's China, her conscience still weighed heavily on her. In her latest book, Beijing Confidential, A Tale of Comrades Lost and Found, she revisits her experience in China as a student and sets out to find Yin. Recounting a recent trip she and her family took to China with the explicit goal of finding the friend she squealed on those many years ago, the book provides a fascinating glimpse of a dogged and a resourceful reporter seeking to make amends, as well as a view on Beijing as it makes the move out of communism into the throes of capitalism. Often humorous, Beijing Confidential is rich in detail and is also instructive. Jan Wong is a reporter for the Globe and Mail in Toronto, where she lives with her family. Her last book, Lunch with Jan Wong, was a collection of her very interesting and fascinating and much talked about columns. This book, published by Doubleday, retails for $34.95. I am pleased to welcome to the Plante on the Line program Jan Wong. Good morning, Ms. Wong.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
How did a third-generation Canadian who was born and raised in Montreal grow up to become a Maoist?
Well, it was the 70s, and it wasn't that uncommon for students to be radical. And I think because I'm ethnic Chinese, I'd always wondered who I was. I was searching for my roots, and I wanted to learn Chinese. We didn't speak it at home. After three generations, we were fluently English. And so I just wanted to go back to China. I majored in Asian studies at McGill University. That's another thing about living here for several generations. You're no longer good in math. And I thought, I'll go back to China for a trip and see the Cultural Revolution, because my professors at McGill told me it was great. It was like this wonderful thing that was happening to Chinese society. And it was the end of exploitation, the beginning of freedom and liberation, and I thought it was a great idea, so I went.
And how did you move away from those ideals that you'd held being a Maoist?
Well, I think that living in China over the years, at the beginning, I was completely enamored of Maoism, because I liken it to living in, I liken it to the Truman Show, where Jim Carrey is living in this completely phony town, but he doesn't know it. He doesn't know that everyone he encounters are acting a role, and he believes this is real life. And I think for me in Beijing, at the height of the Cultural Revolution, and being naive and just learning the language, I didn't understand that the people talking to me didn't really mean what they said. They were parroting the party line. And so I gradually saw problems, and I think my falling out of love with Maoism was a long and gradual and actually quite painful process.
You had roomed at Beijing University with a girl named Erica, correct?
Yes, we weren't roommates. We each had a Chinese roommate, but we lived side by side. She was the only other Westerner there. She was a Chinese-American from Yale University, same age as me. And we had a whole dorm of Chinese, hand-picked Chinese girls move in with us. And we had daily Chinese lessons separate, because Erica spoke much better than I did. She was a second-generation American Chinese, and so she spoke Chinese at home. Couldn't read and write, so we had separate classes.
So Scarlett was your roommate, correct?
Yes, Scarlett was my roommate. She was a very nice young woman who was very obedient, and we lived together for that year.
Now, Yin, she was not your roommate.
That's right. Yin was a young woman that neither Erica nor I knew. She was, I didn't know really which class she was in, what year she was in, and she approached us one day towards the end of our year at Beijing University and asked us to go for a walk with her around the campus lake, and Erica and I were quite happy to do that because almost no one approached us spontaneously. We always were with people that had been approved and vetted. Although it wasn't obvious to us, we could sort of feel like nobody else was talking to us. Only these certain people were talking to us. So we went around the lake with her, and she asked us questions about the West, which was very unusual. No one asked us questions about the U.S. or Canada. And then she suddenly blurted out, "I want to go to the U.S. Can you help me?" And Eric and I were quite startled. Because we had been living in this Maoist bubble, we had willingly been brainwashed. We had happily taken part in our own brainwashing, and we didn't understand that people really did want to go to the West. We thought we would save this young woman from a fate of shopping malls. We thought we would try to do what Chinese did, which was to report. And we thought she would be criticized in a helpful way, not a destructive way, because we had been criticized for various things that we had done, such as reading too many English books. I was always criticized for that. So we thought that would be fine. And so we told our teachers.
But you had worried subsequent to this and in recent years until you made the trip back that she had either been sent away or even killed.
Yes.
Those thoughts crossed your mind, right?
Yes. I didn't remember her until I read my diaries in 1994. I read them because I was finishing my posting in Beijing for the Guobin Mail, and I was planning to write Red China Blues, my first book. And I wanted to refresh my memory about the days at Beijing University. I totally didn't remember this because at the time, it was not a big moral decision, and I did not even envision the consequences. So I told my teacher. She didn't react. She just said fine, and we went on with my lesson, and there was no one gave me a hint that this was going to end up badly for anyone. And so since 1994, I knew, of course, the consequences because I had covered human rights. I had been at Tiananmen Square. I had written about executions and interviewed people who had been in Chinese jails. So I knew the consequences had to be terrible. And so I worried about her, but I didn't do anything about it because, frankly, I was just afraid to look for her.
And so you'd gone back to China since 1994.
Yes, I'd gone back on reporting trips, and I went to do a documentary film once, and I once took my family back for the big tour of China, and each time I was very busy and also reluctant to look for her. I was afraid to look for her. I couldn't really face it. Last year I went back to Beijing to write Beijing Confidential, which was supposed to be a book about Beijing on the eve of the Olympics and how much the city had changed emotionally, psychologically, and physically on the eve of the Olympics. And for the first time I actually felt that I had time to look for her. Previously, I had been completely booked, and as far as all the time, I didn't have the freedom of a month to look for her. I had planned to be in Beijing for 4 weeks, so I thought it's now or never. I think also I had reconciled myself to the idea that if I found her and she really hated me, I could at least handle it, and I would still try to say I was sorry. I was looking for closure. I needed to find out what had happened to her, and I really needed to apologize. So I used my research time for Beijing Confidential to look for her, because part of running around the city and finding out all the latest things was I would have the chance to ask people where she had gone.
A lot of your critics have used this indiscretion in your past as a reflection of your character. What made you want to say sorry, and was it an effort perhaps to dispel some of what your critics have said about you, that perhaps you're cruel and not caring?
I wanted to say sorry because I was sure that I had hurt her. I was sure that I had injured her. And I wanted to say I was really sorry that I understood now what I had done then. And it was important for me to go back and tell her this. It wasn't really to deal with criticism here. That was just something that was that had happened, and I wouldn't have, that wasn't my motivation, because I never had to tell people in the first place that I had done this. When I realized what I had done, I thought about putting it in Red China Blues or not putting it in Red China Blues. I didn't have to. The chances that anyone would know were nil, because it was just me, Erica, and Yin who knew this. And Erica is not a writer. Erica is a scientist. And as far as I know, she's never written anything about China. And it was, so it was just me. And I put it in because I knew I would get a lot of criticism for it, but I put it in because it was important to me, A, to be honest, but B, to explain how the Chinese people themselves could do this so readily, could turn people in, with almost no thought behind it. And I wanted to explain what the Maoist culture had been, that they're not lesser people, that a person from Montreal could go there and happily get brainwashed and do this within a year, report someone. So it was important for me as a journalist to explain why people do this. And so I guess my motive in going back was also to understand for myself why I had done this and why people hurt each other and report. In the efforts to create a new society, people do things like this. I thought it was important to write about it because if I had just gone and apologized, it wouldn't have forced me. The act would be over, and then I'd go off and do something else. By writing a book about it, it forced me to really pull it apart and analyze why I did it, what happened to her, and I thought that was worth doing.
You brought your husband and your sons along. How did they know that you'd done this?
Yes, my husband knew, and I told my older son, and when he was little, I told him. Because, of course, I wrote about it in Red China Blues 11 years ago. So he had heard me talk about it. And my younger son, I think I didn't tell him till recently because I remember when I told my older son, he didn't really get it. I tried to explain as much as I could. But it wasn't that easy for him to understand the impact, the consequences. So I didn't try so hard with my second son. When I told them I wanted to go back to Beijing to write a book about the city on the eve of the Olympics, they moaned and they groaned and they didn't want to go with me. All three of them wanted to stay home. And I had in the back of my mind a plan to use this time to do my best to find Yin. And so I told my kids and my husband that I really wanted them to go with me, but I didn't really explain in great detail why. I just said I wanted them to go, and they were very grumpy about it. I'm always dragging them off on my adventures, and they were tired of this. But I said, I really need you, and I needed them for emotional support because I knew it would be a tough thing to persist in looking for someone who probably hates you and may be very angry with you. It's not easy to do. So I asked them to go with me, and they very grumpily acceded and went with me.
Well, one of your sons was worried that she was going to beat you up if you'd seen her, right?
Yes. When I got really close, when I was just about, when I had made my first contact with Yin, and I had the first phone call from her, I made a plan to see her the next day, and as I was leaving, Sam, who's 13, said, you better be careful, Mom, because she might have hired a band of thugs to beat you up because you ruined her life. And so I was kind of apprehensive. I don't think that was out of the realm of possibility, and I was quite worried, although she seemed quite happy on the telephone when I said, I've been trying to reach you. Do you remember who I am? And she said, I've never forgotten you. And I thought, well, of course, I bet you've never forgotten me. But she didn't seem hostile or sarcastic. And she agreed right away to meet me, so I was hopeful. I apologized on the phone right away because I didn't want to, if that was my only opportunity to talk to her, I didn't want to lose it. So once I said, do you remember me? And she said, yes. I said, I'm really sorry for what I did. And she just brushed it off. And so I didn't understand why she brushed it off. But the story is much more complicated, and it turns out when we met, and we had many meetings, we had as many as I could cram in before I left in the 11 days later, it turns out that I'm not the only person who reported her. She said 25 or 30 other people turned her in. And that just took my breath away. It never occurred to me that if she told me and Erica, complete strangers, that she would have told everybody, all her class, her teachers, and all of them turned her in.
It is a fascinating. Your subsequent meetings with Ian are fascinating, and I don't want to give too much away because it's worth picking up the book simply for that. I want to ask about the resistance that you saw on the part of some of the people that you'd gone to school with that were at the school at the time. It seems, I don't know, is it indicative, do you think, of the Chinese culture or people from that era that they seem resistant to talk about the past or perhaps unwilling to help you?
I thought it was very interesting because as far as I know, I'm the only person I know of who ever went back to find their victim in the Cultural Revolution to apologize. I think there is a selective amnesia in China about the Cultural Revolution, and it's partly because the government has made it a taboo subject. It's not taught in the schools, and it's never discussed in the media, because the Communist Party is still in power. It's the same government, same party that launched the Cultural Revolution. They're still there. And so they don't want to discuss it. It would point the finger right back at them. The second reason is Chinese don't have the tradition of therapy, of talking about problems, of overcoming trauma through psychotherapy or psychiatry or psychology. And so they don't understand how difficult it is to simply cover it up. And I think the other reason that people don't go back to apologize, well, of course, who goes back to apologize? I mean, after the Holocaust, how many of the people who were at the death camps actually go and find their victims and apologize? I don't think anybody does. And you have to have a government that organizes the Truth and Reconciliation Committee for any kind of apologies to happen. Most individuals feel they don't want to go back. Why would they go back and find their victims? It's just going to be so much unpleasantness. But for me, I think I'm different because, one, I studied history. That was my major, and I'm really interested in understanding the past. And two, I'm a journalist, so I am sort of professionally used to going places where people don't want you. You know, having doors slammed in my face and having people yell at you because they don't want to talk to you. So I probably have a tougher skin than ordinary people. And I think also that I'm Canadian, and I think that Canadians do apologize more readily than other nationalities. We even apologize when someone steps on our foot. So I think that combination made me want to go back. And the environment in China is such that nobody else wants to talk about it.
China has changed so much since the time you lived there, and one of the interesting things, having not been there at all, was reading your book and getting a sense of what it was like. Your kids grew up in Toronto, so they're not used to perhaps some of the things that you're used to, having lived there in the past. Did they find it comfortable to go back to such a... the sense that I get, it's quite capitalist now.
Yes. My kids found it hard to be there because the air pollution was so terrible. It's so thick. The smog is so thick that you can't see more than a block distant. It begins to be hazy almost immediately. And the air is toxic. You take a few steps and you start panting. And the days are usually, the skies are gray, not really with clouds, but with smog. And the smog is so thick you can't even identify where the sun is. You can't see the sun through the smog. So usually here, if we have smog, you can still see the disk of a sun somewhere. But in Beijing, it's so thick you can't find the sun. And then you look down and there's no shadows. That is such an unusual experience, not to even see where the shadows are, and yet you feel this intense heat beating down on you. They didn't like that, and they didn't like the traffic. Everywhere there's noise and dust and cars, There's 1,000 new cars hitting the street every day in Beijing. And they keep building more and more roads, but they're clogged with new cars. So the average speed on the expressways is 10 kilometers an hour. So my kids really didn't like that part. You know, there's nowhere to bike or have fun or, you know, but they liked it for the illegal DVDs and the no drinking age. They got considerably less grumpy when they found out 7-Eleven let them buy vodka coolers. And I said, okay, you can have one, but you got to share it. And so they very happily would curl up at night in our apartment and split a vodka cooler. I mean, they're 13 and 16, so it's pretty bad, but, you know, it was so much fun for them, and I had forced them to come with me, so I allowed them to do that.
And is China, is Beijing, are they ready for the Olympics in your estimation?
I think they're ready. The buildings are all ahead of schedule. They're incredible stadiums that are designed by foreign architects. A lot of avant-garde architecture there now. And I think they're ready. They're going to have to clean the air up, though. I don't know how they'll do that. I assume they will just shut down all traffic for a month, which they can do. What they do is they just declare that you can't take your car on the road unless you have a permit, and then they don't issue permits. And that's how they'll do it. We couldn't do that here. People would file lawsuits right away, but there they can do that. I think they'll be ready. And I expect there'll be a lot of human rights protests and, you know, Free Tibet protests, because all the eyes of the world are going to be on Beijing. So there'll be a lot of pressure on the government.
You refer to your husband, Norman, as Fat Paycheck, and that's
yes.
a sort of a literal translation of his Chinese name.
Yes, that's right.
He'd lived there for a number of years. Does he like being called that?
No, he hates it, and he completely disagrees with me over the translation. His name in Chinese is Xu Yulu, and Xu stands for Shulman. His last name is Shulman, and Yu means wealth, and Lu means a government sinecure or government position. So to me, the best translation is Fat Paycheck, but it's funny because when he meets people now, they go, oh, you're Fat Paycheck. And he actually doesn't like it very much, but he puts up with me. He puts up with a lot, you know.
This has been, I would assume, a cathartic experience for you. The importance of seeking to make amends is read through the book. Do you feel that you do that more?
I think I'm so glad that I found her. I was afraid that I would, of what would happen, and secretly I was probably hoping I wouldn't find her, but I would just do my best. But I'm so happy that I found her, because it is there is a very happy ending to the story. And I think it's made me, I guess, a more sympathetic person. I know that I have a reputation after the lunch column of being mean and nasty, but I really think I'm just a journalist who doesn't allow hypocrisy, you know, to go unpunctured. But I think I actually am a nicer person now after this, because I understand that people make mistakes. Lots of people make mistakes. It's hard to find someone who hasn't made a mistake, but it's what you do with it afterwards that matters.
A couple more things before I let you go. Her daughter.
Yes.
Has she come to Canada yet?
No, I think she's still in the process. The last time I talked to her, she was still in the process. Yes, she has a daughter who's in her 20s. She calls her Apple, after the Big Apple. And she's trying to come here, and she's learning French. She wants to go to Quebec, but I don't think she's arrived yet. I'm assuming I would have heard if she was coming, because I said that when she gets here, I'll help her get settled.
And how has Yin or Lu Yi, that's her new name, how has she reacted to the book?
Well, I told her when I had finished it, and she was going, oh, and she's a little worried about what I had said, and I said, well, I'm talking about what happened to you, and she goes, okay. Now, I haven't given her a copy yet, because she doesn't read English. What I'm hoping is that I'll bring her a copy myself and be able to explain to her what I said.
There's a scene where when you finally meet her, and I think you're sitting around her dinner table, she's serving you dinner at her house. And you say that it's sort of like a Woody Allen movie. Do you have a favorite Woody Allen movie?
The one with the lobster. What was that? Where there's the lobster escape?
Annie Hall?
Yeah, Annie Hall. Yeah, I like that. And I think he was standing in a movie line, remember? And
that's right.
Right behind Marshall McLuhan?
Right, right.
That was funny. I like that moment.
There's a woman in the book, I guess one of your teachers had told you about a woman who had fallen...
Oh, yes.
...at Lenin's tomb.
Yes.
And
died.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to give it away, but this is just for my sake, I guess. Is there a connection with one of the characters later in the book?
Yes.
And it's the same person, is it?
Yes.
I was reading the book.
It's incredible.
I was reading the book the other night, and I was just shuddering because, I guess there are no coincidences in life, are there?
Yeah, I know. It's so weird. Like, I'm looking and looking and looking for her, and then she turns out to be, I don't want to give the book away, but there's this eerie coincidence that I don't understand until after I'm meeting her, and it dawns on me that, you know, this is the woman who died. Well, how do I put this? She ends up marrying the husband of the woman who died outside Lenin's tomb because she slipped and fell and cracked her head.
People should pick this up just for that, because it's such a fascinating story
and
really interesting. Jan, thanks so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed talking to you. I'm a huge fan of your work.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It was great.
Thanks for joining us. The book is called Beijing Confidential, A Tale of Comrades Lost and Found. It is worth picking up. It is a well-written and fascinating book for on a number of levels. We ought to pay attention more to China in the next few years, and you can get a good sense of that there, as well as his personal story, which is absolutely fascinating and heartrending. Jan Wong is the author, 3495 from Doubleday. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.